Welcome. It is Chol Hamoed Sukkot 5784. We're continuing our study of the Zohar. We're going to take a brief seasonal diversion to the topic at hand, Sukkot and the Ushbizin in particular, and then return to our discussion of Tohu. And really enter our beginning of Bereshit. I don't know if we'll get there today. In my mind, that would be good if we could get into Bereshit, because Tohu is chaotic and Bereshit is more ordered. So there are really two passages in the Zohar about the Ushbizin, the one that's quoted and the one that we actually studied in the Hakdama, which is less specific, but also about that. And so I wanted to start with this one. So I put it up on the screen. This is from Parshas Emor, and it's from Parshas Emor because that's where the festival, one of the places the festivals are listed. The Zohar says, Tachazi b'sha'ata divarnasha. We'll read it in the Aramaic because that's what we have here in front of us on Sefaria. B'sha'ata divar nashativ b'madorah da tzila d'mheimenuta shchinta parse gadfa le'amile'ela v'avraham v'chamisha tzadikaya achranin shavin madorei hanimei. Amar Rabbi Abba, Avraham v'chamisha tzadikaya v'david malka shavin madorei hanimei. Ki had Rav Hamnuna Saba kad hava ayol lasuka hava chade v'kaimo pischa lasuka megava amar nizamin lushbizin. Then he would say, Tivu Ushbizin, Tivu, Tivu Ushbizin Ilain, which is exactly the text in the Machzor. So what does that mean? I'll read the translation. Come and see. At the time when a person comes to dwell in the shade of the Sukkah, which is the shade of faith, the divine presence spreads her wings over him from above, and Abraham and five other tzaddikim and David make their dwelling with him. This is borne out by the custom of Rav Hamnuna Tzava. And the Sukkah would say the guests are invited to enter. So this is a passage in the Zohar. I'll stop the share now. And it's based on an implicit reading of the verse, Basukot Teshvu Shivat Yamin. In Sukkot you should dwell for 7 days. It's always important to know what the reread is or the creative misinterpretation. I know there was some scholar that runs, was it Harold Bloom? I don't know. Someone wrote a whole thing on creative misinterpretation. Well, that's what the Zohar loves to do. They call it sod in Kabbalah, but I call it creative misinterpretation. Right?
Harold Bloom did write a book on Kabbalah.
Yeah, I think it was Harold Bloom. I read.
I don't recall him saying that, but the book is excellent.
It is. Anyway. Yeah. No. That is true. I think it might have been him, but maybe it was someone else. And, what do we normally when we say Basukot Teshvu Shivat Yamim? We mean you should dwell in Sukkot for 7 days, or some people over literalize it and sit in Sukkot. And they think Teshvu means sit. And so they sit when making the bracha and get very obsessive, like the person that yelled at me at Kiddush last week. You stood, you didn't sit, you couldn't make the bracha. I think I'm okay. It means to dwell. There was no chair. So there is a legitimate custom to sit, etc. So Basukot Teshvu Shivat Yamim, the Zohar rereads here implicitly. Basukot Teshvu Shivat Yamim, the 7 days should come and dwell in Sukkot. Do you see? It's not that we should dwell in Sukkot for 7 days, but the 7 days should come and dwell in Sukkot. And what are the 7 days? And they're playing on the kind of backwards, which is fine in Hebrew, order of the, you know, it sounds like Yiddish. In Sukkahs, you should dwell 7 days. Obviously, it doesn't actually read like that. It's missing et. Right? It doesn't say Basukot Teshvu et Shivat Hayamim. It doesn't say that, you know, but that's how the Zohar reads it. Basukot Teshvu et Shivat Hayamim. The 7 days should come into dwell in Sukkot. The 7 days. And that explains why Sukkot is a 7-day holiday, with Shemini Atzeret, of course, to symbolize the Sfira Ot. So the Sfirot all come, which are here called days of creation, which is going to link back to what we do in Bereshit, where the 7 days of creation are going to get created as Sfirot. So this is, you know, back. This is a forward look in time about how what we'll do in Parshat Bereshit will be interpreted. But those days should come and dwell in Sukkot. Or rather, when we dwell in the Sukkah, which is the Tzila Demheimenuta, the shade of faith, the Zohar's, you know, this is a term Zohar coins, which becomes, I think, popular, right? Tzila Demheimenuta, I mean, I don't know if popular, but relatively popular as a term for the Sukkah, the shadow of faith. In other passages, it seems to mean that why a shadow? Because your shadow, as many of the Kabbalists explain about Sukkot and the Zohar, your shadow does what you do. You know, it mirrors you. Or shadows, I don't know, shadows you. It shadows you. I don't know what the right word
is. But the shadow is given shape, so it can't be his shadow. It's got to be somebody else's shadow. Your own shadow cannot give you shape. Okay?
Right, it's the shade of faith. It's not the shadow of faith. It's called sail here, shade. And so the shadow created by the shade is a way of understanding that whatever we do, in other words, when they say Basukot Teshu Shivat Yamim, what they have in mind here is that we will iterate, emphasize, connect with, channel the energy of the various Sfirot on different days as manifest by an external representation of those. In other words, we'll almost channel an inner, you know, there's a popular theory in therapy now, PARTS, or internal family system, IFS. I don't know if people are familiar with this. It's a therapeutic and psychoanalytic system. And so they imagine that a useful way for people to deal with their problems is to relate to the various parts of themselves as beings. And so, you know, if I give a bad drasha and I see that everyone has fallen asleep and I get mad at the congregants for falling asleep instead of myself for giving another boring sermon, there's a part of me that I don't know, just wants to be liked and loved, and no one liked what I said that day, clearly as manifest by the fact that they all decided to take a nap instead. It just wasn't interesting enough to keep anyone awake for 4 minutes. So rather than becoming obsessed with that, if I can identify, well, what part of that is me, and what's its history, and where does it come from, and relate to that as a part, and then another part of me that doesn't care, and another part of me that's generous and says people are tired from too much davening, it's amazing they're there at all. They came to hear the speech. They didn't walk out. Whatever, different parts. I'm not giving a good example, but there are different parts of a person, and it will be useful for people to relate to and not dismiss the voices inside, but rather to create little devils and angels on their shoulder out of the various parts in them. So the Zohar is engaging in a kind of internal family system game here. It wants us to conjure up our ancestors who represent the seven Sfirot as guests to be with us in our Sukkah. In fact, that's the point of the mitzvah, says the Zohar. It's not to be in it for 7 days, but to bring the 7 days into the Sukkah, to emanate God fully through the Sfirot in the Sukkah. Which is why there's this weird debate in the art scroll Machzor, you know, because the seven are not in chronological order of the Tanakh. Abraham, Yitzchak, Yaakov, Moshe, Aaron, Vidavid, I miss Yosef. So Yosef comes after Moshe and Aaron in the Kabbalistic system. Yosef is Yesod, Tzadik Yesod Olam is the, you know, the...
He's right above the Shekhinah.
Exactly.
In
chronology, Yosef comes right after Yaakov. So some people do the Ushbizin in the chronological order, whereas some people do it in the Sviriotic order. But the whole custom, I'll say, is rooted in the idea, the entire custom of Ushbizin comes from the Zohar and is about the idea that the seven Sfirot needs to emanate in order in the Sukkot. So to do the Ushpizin in chronological order is like the Litvishization of like the Kabbalistic custom. Not that you can't be a Litvak and a Kabbalist, but like, in other words, it takes this custom and totally just doesn't understand anything about its origins or meaning.
Is it the case that the Ushpizin custom did not exist before the Zohar?
So, not exactly. And this is my next point. That was point one. Pasukoteshu Shivat Yamim et Shivat Hayamim, and that's the Ushpizin. And that transforms the whole mitzvah as one where we cause to dwell in us or with us or projected by us in the world these sfirot. And it's an act of practice. I kind of think it's interesting and fun, especially when saying the Zohar. I know I invite them every night. In Aramaic, and my family thinks I'm weird. So, there was a practice of inviting guests to the sukkah, which this seems to be rooted in, according to many scholars. And that comes from the specific link of "Vissamachta bechagecha" in the Torah, with. The song skips the whole verse and a half in between. It's Vissamechta bechagecha. You have to give charity, you and the lady and the stranger and the orphan and the widow and all the disparaged classes that the Torah quotes, and make sure to give them the maaser and the various tithes and charity, etc. V'hayita ach sameach, and then you'll be happy. Ends the two verses, I think. I don't even think it's one verse. So there clearly was a custom that many cite a specific custom of inviting guests on Sukkot. By the way, we have this with every one of, we have it with Pesach too, of Maot Chitin, of a custom of giving, money for people to have Yom Tov meals. So
Yeah,
it's
hold it in. Yeah,
you
take
can't lay a call. So we have a version of it at, in the Pesach Sukkot. There are a lot of similarities, including the link of the rabbis between the 15th and the 15th, and a mitzvah to eat at night on the 15th. And the parallel season, spring, fall, regel. But there clearly was a custom to invite guests, just like on Pesach. I think it's a parallel custom. And actually, we did a passage in the Hakdamah, I don't know if you remember it, where Avraham has a weaning festival, the weaning festival for Yitzchak. And at that festival, the Satan comes disguised as a pauper and isn't fed by Avraham, who's like, sorry, party's too full. And Avraham is too busy to notice, I think. Look, I could look back to read it if you want. And as a result, that Satan then goes and challenges God in a Job-esque allusion. And then God says, well, here, we'll do the Akedah. And in the end of the Zohar passage, because of the Akedah, Sarah dies, right? So the Zohar has links explicitly Avraham's failure to Avraham, who's the guy who always feeds the stranger. That's, he's the guy who does it when he's still circumcised, just. But even Avraham fails at a time when he's self-indulged in this version of it. And as a result, sets in forth a demonic series of events that caused the death of his wife and suffering and the near, sacrifice of his child. And the Zohar concludes in that passage that that's why we have to make sure at the regel, at the moed, at the festival, and it cites explicitly Sukkot, to make sure that there are guests who are fed as a tikkun for the possibility that we would engage in self-indulgence without feeding the poor. And so people always quote the passage I just quoted in Amor when talking about the Ushpizin, but I think that passage in Amor needs to be seen with the parallel passage in the Hakdama. That's the thing I'm adding here, to understand that for the Zohar and the Shlah, Rabbi Zeh Levi Horowitz cites this explicitly. It's not my own idea, that he felt
But he's
that,
your father-in-law, right?
well, he is my wife's great, great, great. He's Right. We're your family too on the wife's
My
side.
wife
Your
related
wife and my wife.
so slow Yom
Great.
Tov. We married well.
Yes. We both married into illustrious Ravenic dynasties. So the Shlach cites this idea that the Zohar didn't have in mind an abstract concept, but it had in mind that there should be a guest at the meal. Who's designated as like your Avraham, the way the Shlach says it, your Yitzchak tonight, like a
Oh.
poor person or someone. So the Shlach imagines, like, actually cites this the custom then in, I guess, Prague in the 1500s, you know, to have poor people each night in the Sukkah who could be plausibly designated as the Ushpizin in disguise. I think that custom is a blend of this. Avraham passage, and you know, you could just take this and make it some mystical practice, and it could have nothing to do with the moral obligation to feed people that don't have a meal, or the.
Why four? You said four people, not seven, not
Oh no,
one.
no.
That's
I must have missed. I'm just
okay.
tired of that. It should be seven people, right?
Okay.
Yeah, there should be. There should be.
It's a great kids program. We used to have people dress up and go visit a sukkah, and I'm guess who I
Oh.
am, and you can.
Oh, that's really interesting. I love that. So that's what I want to to answer your question, Peter. Yeah, I think this is related to the general, it's a mystical take on the custom of having the poor and, by the way, of course, manifesting the Shekhinah, who is the ultimate exiled, impoverished. The Shekhinah is called Dal or poor. It's the moon is dependent in Kabbalah. And so I think, you know, that's where this emerges, right? Is actually the poverty isn't incidental to it, but summons the notion of a Shekhinah in exile, which the Sukkah represents, right? A kind of fallen temple or a Shekhinah in exile. I think they kind of work in that illusion
Just
for
a
sure.
sukkah in its,
yeah,
I'm
go
sorry.
ahead, Peter.
Sukkot in its origin is a farmer's holiday, not a herdsman's holiday. And it disguises a lot of fear about starvation because you're once you have a harvest festival, you either have enough food till late spring or you're going to be in a big problem and there may be starvation. So I think a lot of that forcing yourself to be happy and it has a certain Halloween type essence to it. Both Halloween and Sukkot deal with the issue of the terror of an inadequate harvest. Halloween, they exaggerate it and get it over with in one night. And Sukkot, we sort of huddle with God and hope for the best. That's maybe that's off
Pray for
point, but
rain
I,
and pray for rain.
In pressure, right? Yeah, indeed.
It's not even so disguised, right?
It
Emerges during service. Till you get to the end is the actual prayer for rain.
Yeah.
Before that, you have the four species, which suggest water and rain. They're water-dependent species. You don't find them in the desert unless there is a whatever they call it,
No, in the
an
Hoshana,
oasis.
you know. Aniva Hoshiana, you know, save us now is not exactly what a great harvest. Save us now is because we're in dire need. So,
And that just to now get off it, that corresponds interestingly with Pesach. In the Pesach is not a farmer's holiday, it's in essence a herdsman's holiday, and they sacrifice the new calf. And that's full of hope and looking forward. We got through it, and we're now sacrificing the first calf, and it's going to be sweet now for a few months. That's how I see them. I think that's behind the question also of whether the new year begins in the fall or begins in the spring. That's a farmer's custom is to do it in the fall when the harvest is over. Herdsmen
This is an interesting
celebrate the new year
dichotomy. I
with a new
appreciate
calf.
dividing the rabbinic tradition into farmers and herdsmen in this dichotomy.
Well, we had ancestors before rabbis.
What?
Before we had rabbis, we had ancestors who did other things for a living.
So
I had
think,
a different technical question. The passage that you read, you gave this drasha about Shivat Yamim becomes the seven days Sphirot. Was that in that Emor passage,
it
or
is.
that's
There was an
your
ellipsis there, but
understanding of it?
they quote that verse that he would say Basukot Shivat Yamim, and then that Rav Hamnuna Sava would say Basukot Teshvu Shivat Yamim before summoning them. So I think my interpretation of Rav Hamnuna Sava would go in and invite them and say Basukot Teshvu Shiva Yamin Tivu Tivu Shbizini Lain. They're the higher guests, and then invite them is kind of like the primordial Sunday, the primordial Monday, Avraham Yitzchak Yaakov. So I think it's basically explicit. Also of note, Rav Hamnuna Sava is not just any Tana in the Zohar, but as we saw from a passage in the Hakdama, which is a formative passage about Rav Hamnuna Sava and the teaching of Shabbat and the donkey. I don't remember that teaching, but Rav Hamnuna Sava is like the second most important sage in the Zohar. He has a, I would say he's parallel to what's his name? The miracle worker who's always doing.
Chuni, Chuni,
Maybe
Chori
not.
HaMagdil.
Yeah, or who's the one in the Mishnah in Brachot who there's like a snake
Hanina ben
on
Tosa.
him? Chanina ben Dosa.
Hanina ben Tosa.
So Chanina ben Dosa has all these miracle stories about him. And Rabbi Benny Lau has a piece about how Chanina ben Dosa represents actually the last of a dying breed in his mind in the oral law of, magical miracle men of the prior generation. And now they don't have Chanina ben Dosa anymore. They just have legalists and jurists. And that's a transition, but they're also doing it by lauding the past, which no longer exists. So Rav Hamnuna Sava serves a parallel role in the Zohar of being this, in addition to Rabbi Shimon Bar Yochai, who's oddly, I think I mentioned Rav Shimon Bar Yochai knows everything that's happening. He's omniscient in the Zohar. It's like you'd miss it, but whenever they come, he knows exactly what's been said and taught, even though they weren't with him. He has omniscience. So that certainly makes him seem like this magical sage because he knows everything that happens, even when he's not there. And once in a while they return to him. But Rav Hamnuna Sava has a different kind of like is seen as like a great from a prior time, a mythic great. And so the fact that he does it is significant. He's one of the only other ones in the Zohar who could innovate a mandatory practice. Like he did it, and therefore we must. Not everyone can do that, but Rav Hamnuna Sava can do that. We'll go back. Does everyone have a copy, or do you want me to share on the screen?
I have a copy. I don't know about Peter.
You want me to share?
I do not, but I oh, which volume is it?
Volume one, but I'm happy to share.
Yeah, sure.
So last time we discussed darkness is black fire, and we discussed how this idea of darkness is actually the darkness of a candle. I don't know if people recall, and it creates destruction, etc. What I want to say here is twofold. The way this passage is taken, this is a very difficult passage, this whole passage about Tohu, by many of the Kabbalistic interpreters. I was reading commentaries to try and shed some light on it for myself, is to understand that there's a repetitive process going on. First of Tohu and Bohu, Tohu being chaos, energy, or a kind of tzimtzum. Obviously, the Zohar doesn't quite have the idea of tzimtzum, but there are seeds of it in the Zohar, including the idea that chaos was a first creation. It's not far from the idea that God's self-contraction is a first move. It's not as firm as the Lurianic idea, not as dramatic, but it's similar. And then Bohu is a giving form to the matter of chaos, right? So Bohu is a kind of tikkun, as it were, of the tohu. And then you have Choshech and Ruach, darkness and spirit or wind. So there's a kind of twofold repetitive energy of concealment and then some form of concretization or revelation, followed again by a move towards contraction and revelation. And some of the Kabbalists understand this to be, once they already have the idea of Tzimtzum from the Arizal, a statement of Tzimtzum and then God's emanation into the void, and or a repetitive Tzimtzum or contraction from Bina, a secondary contraction. Anyway, however you want to take it technically, you get this idea that there's a kind of repetitive yin and yang pole going on. So let's keep reading. And
what, if you know, what page are you on in the Prisker, volume one?
I do know.
I like to take notes in this.
120, I have.
Okay. Thank you.
The page numbers are on the side.
On the side, yes. Yeah.
Darkness is black fire. So we did Tohu, now Choshech. Darkness is black fire. Soon we're going to get to Breishit, and it actually gets a little bit more understandable. You can say that. Darkness is black fire, potent in color. Red fire, potent in appearance. Green fire, potent in shape. White fire, embracing all. Darkness, most powerful fire, empowers Tohu. Darkness is fire, but not dark fire, until it empowers Tohu. This is the mystery of, his eyes were too dim to see, and he called Esau. Darkness, face of evil, for he greeted evil with a friendly face. Then it is called darkness, for it settles upon it, empowering it. This is the mystery of darkness over the face of the abyss. Choshech al pnei tchum. So, Malila taught me it's always good to sometimes just read the full passage and let the mythic ethos of it settle. We have an idea here, and then we have that idea represented in a biblical narrative. So I just want to flesh out both the idea and then how it's used in the narrative, and then we'll move on from that. I like the idea that we settled on of looking at a candle. And so if you imagine here that darkness is fire, but not dark fire until it powers Tohu, there's this idea that darkness, right, Tohu Vavo V'choshech, that darkness is a later emergent stage in the forces we're talking about. It's not the first. It grows darker when it empowers or forms like an atmosphere for the chaos. The darkness of a candle melts the wax or destroys. It takes the form of the thing and evaporates it. Right? If you're looking from an ancient perspective, it seems you don't understand combustion. You have a candle and the candle is gone because the dark part of the fire makes it disappear. So darkness.
It's like interesting, though. The white fire is what we like. But we need to be reminded that it's powered by a dark fire that is destructive.
Right. The white fire gives light, but it's founded on a basis of fire
darkness.
That fuels and destroys and causes things. It's like a black hole of energy. It takes matter and turns it formless. in this version of it. And so this is the understanding of the biblical verse. His eyes were too dim to see, and he called Esau. What does it mean? His eyes were too dim to see, and he called Esau darkness, face of evil, for he greeted evil with a friendly face. Right, so it's like his eyes dimmed. Let's just catch the reading. Because he greeted evil, it causes his eyes to grow darker. And it causes the vision to be destroyed because he's blessing or empowering evil.
I think, and he's attracted to a certain extent by that dark side of Esau in many commentaries.
Right. And this one.
Yeah. So it's not just the dimming of his eyes. It's what he really likes. He's not in control.
And Matt in 93 identifies this kind of dark fire power with Gevurah. And when we were talking about the Ushbiz, and I didn't realize that each of the seven have a biblical figure. So Isaac that we're talking about here is Gevurah. So the power of Gevurah in this fire might be something else going on under this.
Yes, in the Sphero chart, we should have had Chesed is Avraham, Gevurah is Yitzchak, and Yaakov is Tiferet or Emet, you know, Titein Emet, the Yaakov, Chesed Avraham, etc. Moshe is Netzach, and Aaron is Hod, and they are, which is represented by Nivla, respectively, and Yosef, it's Sadiq, and David is the Shekhinah. That's the Kabbalistic understanding of the personage of the Sphirot.
And the gender thing is interesting, too. I mean, from Yitzhak in this is a feminine power, as is Bina, and as is the Shekhinah.
Right, as is David.
Who's penetrated by Abraham's masculine power.
Okay. That's right. And Yitzchak is seen as a passive personality, if we wanted to over-gender stereotype the way it's done, as a kind of korban, as a as his mother's child, right? And so they...
Well, not to go off on this, but there are modern people who identify as sexually fluid, who see Yitzhak as in the Torah as portraying a pious homosexual who wishes to comply with the halakha, but his heart is not in it. He was abused as a child. He has no interest in who his wife's going to be, and he's very submissive to her once he gets what somebody gives her to him. And Avraham clearly has a concern. He's never going to get a wife if I don't get involved. I'm not saying that's right, but I'm saying that has appealed to many recent commentators in that world.
I did not know that.
Interesting.
I learn something new every Wednesday. And
right.
I appreciate that. But so even in the Zohar here, there is this feminine identification with Yitzchak, and here there is an identification with Gevurah, and explicitly the demonic here, right? A friendly face to evil that empowers it, right? In other words, and there's theurgic power given to Yitzchak's friendly greet of evil. But of course, this represents something in all of us if we wanted to psychologize it or personalize it, which is that all of us have an attraction to some things that are Gevurah, which can be seen as evil and can feed and empower the demonic. In fact, that is very basic, the Zohar is telling us. Now, it's more basic than our better angels. There's a book, The Upside of Your Dark Side, that is one of my favorite self-help books. And it's one of these airport, I got in an airport kind of a thing. It's one of those. So I was like, well, that's different. It's not about how I can be more productive. It's like how you can use your worst traits to better advantage. And I was like, huh, let me look at that. And in there, the psychologist explains the pro-social evolutionary development of, rage and all of these various seemingly maladaptive things and how they're actually quite constructive. For example, angry people are much more likely to get their way. A more hyped up version of the squeaky wheel gets the oil. So people don't, they have fewer friends, but they also get what they want. They said in a study in that book, if you scream at the person on the other end of the line and ask for the manager, well, you are more likely to get what you are trying to get than if you just take the answer you've given. And so the Zohar is saying something deeper than that here, though, which is that this kind of contraction or gvura energy is a building block of a finite society that isn't divine, right? In other words, if we want to move away from God, then we have to be exercising powers of gvura. And powers of gvura are inherently corporeal, inherently limiting, inherently non-transcendent, inherently delineating, and can be inherently demonic. Here, gvura manifests as dark fire when it strengthens the demonic, causing chaos and things to disappear and melt. But that energy is seen as foundational to the DNA of the spiritual universe, which is why Tohu comes first. Now, there's probably more to think about there. How far back, how do the roots of evil go? Evil is overly simplified. Then it is called darkness, for it settles upon it, empowering it. Right? So dimness really becomes darkness when it empowers evil. This is the mystery of darkness over the face of the abyss. Darkness over the face of the abyss, just to be clear, means empowering the creation of evil and the demonic. But just like they're using a metaphor, just Isaac looked at Esav and empowered evil by blessing him, which caused his eyes to darken and disappear like fire melts things. So too, darkness over the face of the water in the early days, that is a friendly look from darkness over the abyss, empowered the creation of dark forces. Ruach, wind, is a voice hovering over Bohu, empowering and conducting it with whatever is needed. This is the mystery of the voice of Hashem is upon the waters, Kol Hashem al Hamayim. And similarly, the wind of God hovering over the face of the waters, stones sunk in the abyss from which water issues. So it is called face, face of the abyss. The wind conducts and empowers that face, face of the waters, each one receiving what it needs. So, darkness causes things to melt or disappear, causes matter to not have form, causes chaos or tohu, empowers demonic energy or entropy, if we were. Here, wind is a parallel but opposite function. Now, what happens? Let's just take the metaphors literally when wind blows on the water. The water ripples. Yeah, the water waves. Like when wind blows the water, it moves the water. So that's what they mean by face of the abyss, right? It causes structure to the surface of the water to emerge. They also imagine that this energy in the water causes the formation of bohu. So if choshech causes tohu, ruach mirachefet causes bohu, causes form to emerge. Choshech destroys form, and ruach creates form in this version of it. Or like I think of erosion perhaps as a metaphor here, or evaporation. Some of the wind, the energy causes stone sunk into the abyss to form, right? Causes the opposite of that thing. Now, I will say Reuven Kimmelman has done some writing on this tangentially because of the importance of this idea. This is the mystery of the voice of Hashem is upon the waters in the Kabbalat Shabbat ritual. And so in his magnum opus on Lecha Dodi that he wrote, I don't know if people know Reuven Kimmelman, but he's quite the expert of liturgy. And he's in Boston, isn't he? Is he in Boston?
Yeah, Brandeis.
Brandeis. So this is taken by the Ari as reason to recite this before the onset of Shabbat, because Kol Hashem al Hamayim, the voice of God over the waters, causes an energy which empowers form, which is like Zecher the Maaseh Bereishit. Okay. Now we've got
what is the water in this? Is that Bohu? Is that form? It seems like the wind is specifically doing something with the waters.
Yeah, the wind is blowing the water. And somehow that energizes the water. Here they have empowering and conducting it. I think conducting it here means creating conductivity. Could look in the Hebrew, but my sense is that the wind energizes the water in a way that causes form to concretize. So they imagine that this wind energizes the water, or the wind is really the Kol Hashem. Wind is not just wind, but it's the voice of God on the water, which causes the creation of form.
That's interesting, because that's exactly how it looks to a human, right? I mean, you have a calm lake, and then the wind comes and it's full of white caps. I mean, it transforms utterly the face of the water, and you can't see it.
Right. And I think they must have been looking at a body of water on a windy day, just like they were looking at a candle.
Yes.
And imagining the voice of God coming and transforming the face of the water and creating form to it. And imagining that that process does it not just on the surface of the water, but deep within the water, too. It transforms not
because
just...
you're getting surf and all that. Not it, suddenly so it has a surf. Suddenly it's throwing things up to the beach.
And, yeah. And stones come up to the beach. Where did those stones come from? Maybe they came from the wind.
Yes.
In fact, in another way, the stones did come from the wind, from the waves created by, I mean, they may, I don't know how much they knew about erosion. Now we're going to go through this tohu, bohu, choshech, ruach thing again, but interspersed it with divine names. So we've done it twice already now, or three times. We're going to go back through for one more time. Tohu, bohu, choshech, ruach. They keep going through it. Tohu, bohu, choshech, ruach. It's like a trance-like thing. Tohu. Upon it rests the name Shaddai. Bohu. Upon it rests the name Tzvaot. Hosts. Darkness. Upon it rests the name Elohim. Wind. Upon it rests the Shem Havayah. Name Yod-Heh Vav-Heh. So we've now attributed four names, four divine names, to these four energies. These are four manifestations of divinity. One thing to say, Matt has a note here about Shaddai, about its obscure mountain origin. I'll read it. Note 97, an obscure divine name which may mean of the mountain, the traditional rendering Almighty is unjustified. Here Shaddai designates the sphere of Yesod, limiting the destructive power of Tohu. See Chagiga, where Rish Lakish interprets Shaddai as a reference to God's command to limit the universe at creation. I am the one who said to the world, die, you know, Amar La'olam, die.
Yeah.
So, just to be clear, I think they're just working with the classic rabbinic understanding from the Gemara. when they say tohu sha'amar la'olam dai, tohu is about the absence of form in this statement of it. So the Zohar is just saying the name of God that corresponds to setting limits to the ordering, that stops ordering things, right? That stops the energy that causes order. That divine energy, the divine energy that causes the absence of form, is tohu. And bohu, it's svaot, because it's the legions of things. Darkness Elohim, because of an association with gvura, with strength and judgment, and wind, kol Hashem al hamayim, like we just quoted from Psalms. But also that is rachamim, or compassion. They're working with here in all of these, the classic rabbinic understandings of these divine names, not the Kabbalistic. That's the key to understand, right? They're just working with the way the Talmud relates to it, or people would teach you in Hebrew school. Do people teach about divine names in Hebrew school? I don't know. I did. I learned about them in my Hebrew school. So maybe, you know, the like the Shem Havaya is Midat HaRachamim, and Elohim is the name of Gvura. I think those are common teachings, sort of common. Now, they're going to go back to our passage from Elijah, because you remember we also equated these four things. We've equated them with biblical stories and biblical characters. We've equated them with the Spirit, equated them with many things. We've also equated them with the various things that Elijah encountered when he ran from, what's his name, Ahab and Jezebel,
yeah.
And in his fight with the prophets. The fake prophets. A great mighty wind splitting mountains and shattering rocks. Hashem was not in the wind. This name was not in it. For Shaddai controls it through the mystery of Tohu. After the wind, an earthquake. Hashem was not in the earthquake. For the name Tzvaot controls it through the mystery of Bohu. So the wind. Now, you may ask, or you may already be asking, wait, I thought wind was the name of Hashem. I don't know if you're asking this question, but if you're following it, you may be asking the question I asked myself, which is, wait, what? Wind, you just told me wind, kol Hashem alamayim, ruach, ruach is Hashem. But now you're telling me ruach is Tohu, and ruach is not the name of Hashem, but rather the name of Shaddai, which is the name of Tohu. I'm confused, you may say. I don't know. I said that. That's what I wrote in my margin. So the answer I came up with for myself to a question you may or may not have asked is that the wind here in that Elijah is encountering is not the Ruach Hashem or the Kol Hashem Alamayim. It's a different kind of wind, a destructive wind, which they imagine to be Tohu. I'm thinking of it more like a hurricane. Which doesn't alter the face but causes total destruction, right? I think they're considering it like a storm, but I don't know.
Is Ruach HaKodesh something different? I mean, that's a meditation goal, right? But not understood as the name of God. I may be wrong about that.
Yeah. I
discussed it with the book.
Yeah, Ruach HaKodesh is right. It's something else. That's like a spirit inhabiting. So here, this wind, you see, it's destructive. Right, this ruach is not, it's shattering, splitting mountains and shattering rocks. So I think they understand it as tohu energy because the description of this wind is not that it does anything to the deep, but rather this wind takes things that are formed and yun and it shatters them. Right, so it takes matter. Do you see how they take the wind as, no, it's not really just winds, it's energy in the vision of Elijah that shatters things and destroys things. And then an earthquake. Now, interestingly, here the earthquake is equated with Bohu. Why? Bohu is called, because remember, Bohu is about the creation of forms. How do earthquakes create form? Earthquakes destroy things too. Earthquakes could be Tohu. Yeah. They make buildings go kaboom. So you could answer, well, no, earthquakes actually cause, you know, geologic features to form. And so they cause form. But they did not know yet about tectonic plates and things because that guy who discovered it and was ridiculed in his lifetime for theorizing it. What's his name? You know who I'm talking about? The guy who came up with tectonic plate theory was ridiculed as like a quack during his life. I once listened to a
doctor. Too bad Peter Salson's not here. He probably would know this.
He had all this evidence and he was pretty sure this was going on. And everyone in the scientific community thought this guy was just off his rocker. And he lived a lot of his life in shame as an outcast for a scientific theory that eventually was vindicated. I forget.
What do you know when he lived?
Somewhat surprisingly recently.
Really?
I could be wrong. I definitely listened to a program about him once, and I clearly don't remember the
back
details.
Back to the Zohar.
Yeah. So earthquake here, but so the answer stated, they asked the question implicitly in between. So Bo is called earthquake. Why? The question isn't there, but it may as well be there. Why? Question mark. For it does not exist without quaking. You see, the earthquake causes. Now, what do they mean here by quaking? I think they mean in people. It causes fear. Which the formation, Bohu, of demons also causes. That's actually the way I'm understanding it. Earthquakes cause quaking, just like the form or the dark form of created matter causes quaking. I'll keep reading just for a little bit.
Yeah, right.
After the earthquake, fire. Hashem was not in the fire, for the name Elohim controls it, from the side of darkness. Again, we've already linked. So we're not surprised by the equation of fire and darkness. We might have thought they were opposites before, but we now know that actually fire causes darkness, that darkness is luminous, though not transparent. And fire actually, when empowered, has the most powerful element of it being the dark part. It destroys things, which is the name Elohim, right? Fire is destructive and scary here. And so after the wind, Tohu, and the earthquake, Bohu, and the fire, Choshech, Tohu, Vavohu, V'choshech, Apnei Tohom. After the fire, the sound of sheer silence, Ruach Elohim Merachavet Apnei Amayim. Here is found the name Yud-Heh-Vav-Heh. So, interestingly, the wind, which is noisy, the fire is equated to darkness, and the wind, which is noisy, is equated to silence. Because, of course, it's a cold mama daka in the passage in Elijah. That's what this is, the sound of sheer silence. And I think the idea here, if we just take it for a moment, is that in order to create a world, all of the energy and emanate a world, a lot of the emanated energy coming from God is that of constriction, of limitation, of chaos. In other words, there needs to be an absence of, a constriction of, a limiting of divine energy in order to get material matter and form to exist. And so you need to, you have a paradox where in order to get existence to emanate as it does now, you need the absence of divinity. But in order to get anything, you need the presence of divinity. And so they're dealing with this. In this way, by emphasizing in this passage the Olam HaTohu, the priority ontologically of the world of chaos, and then the world and the Bohu in it, and the darkness present, and only in the silence, that is, God is not found in those things, because those things are formed from the absence of God's active emanation, as it were. So God is found in the kol dmama daka, in practices which don't seek to find God in those things, but rather seek to find God anywhere else. It's like equivalent to meditative practices about emptying the mind always. or Sufi practices that are like that, that are sometimes quoted by Avraham ben Harambam. So
it seems like there's some creative activity going on before the appearance of the divine. And in both of these images, the ruach and then the silence of God comes last in the four stages.
Yes, it comes last.
That's what I understood you saying, that all right, in our terms, you know, the spiritual essence of God only comes after all the mess and of physical stuff that somehow evolves on its own, but can't really exist or do anything meaningful without the presence of God that comes at the end.
And so you see how this becomes a predecessor, I think, and Lurianic Kabbalists believe this is alluding to concepts of tzimtzum, of God's withdrawal, because these passages hint very strongly at the idea of that, and at Gnostic ideas of kind of primordial evil existing very early, or even earlier than forces of good and love. They're only coming in the Olam HaTikun as a response after that. So whether metaphysically or mythologically or in different angles you could take, here we've kind of charted the root of the earliest roots of creation in forces of darkness, chaos, or in order, chaos with form or bohu, darkness, which is destructive and judgmental, and then ruach, which is really silence here. The Zohar is interpreting. It's saying, you know what the ruach of God is? It's withdrawing from the chaos and knowing that God is not in those things. But they're really taking the passage of Elijah strongly. God is not in this. God is not in that. God is not in this, right? God is not in the Olam HaTohu. That's the Olam HaTohu is created by not God. It's created by God, but it's created by God's version of not God. That's the teaching here. And that happens first.
Right. Which is radical in some way. There's a creative process going on that's absent of God, and God appears in the end.
Yes. Now, obviously not entirely absent, because God is the one and God's divine names rest upon this Olam HaTohu. But it's the Zohar paradox, you know? But I do think this is a Gnostic-like passage in that it's kind of got this primordial evil it's introducing to us. And next time we're going to get to then let there be light, you know. Does that mean we've now laid the groundwork? And just to review, Haaretz haita tohu vavohu, haita daika, as the Zohar says, it really was first. First, you have to understand. First, it was like this before the first verse. Before Breshit Bara Elohim et haShamayim v'et haAretz, which we learned was the creation of Keter, Chochma, and Bina. Before that, says the Zohar, there was a creation of Tohu and Bohu and Choshech. And only in the absence of those things did divinity exist.
Mm-hmm.
I don't exactly know what to do with this passage still. So first we'll end this next week at the beginning with a little cryptic passage about Elijah and mystical names. And then we'll get to light. So next week, stay tuned. Light, but light here represents Olam HaTikun, a world not of Tohu, but it's parallel Tikun or repair. Happy Sukkot.
Okay, thank you.
We're going to open next time with reflections on this. If people have, so this is actually like a lot, and I don't want to just leave it in the void.
Just the sad thing is Tuesday night Talmud beginning next week.
I believe Tuesday night Talmud is beginning in 2 weeks. I'll check. I think it's not this week, but I think it's in 2 weeks. I think because I'm traveling.